Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. That Woman, the Life of Wallis Simpson, Duchess of Windsor, tells the story of the American divorcee, notorious for allegedly seducing a British king off his throne. That woman, so called by Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, was born Bessie Wallis Warfield in 1896 in Baltimore. Neither beautiful nor brilliant, she endured an impoverished childhood, which fostered in her a burning desire to rise above her circumstances. Acclaimed biographer Anne Seba offers an account of one of the most talked-about women of her generation. It explores the obsessive nature of Simpson's relationship with Prince Edward, the suggestion that she may have had a disorder of sexual development, and new evidence showing that she may never have wanted to marry Edward at all. Since her death, Simpson has become a symbol of female empowerment as well as a style icon, but her psychology remains an enigma. Drawing from interviews and newly discovered letters, That Woman shines a light on a very complex woman, an object of fascination that has only grown with the years. Anne Seba is a biographer, lecturer, and former Reuters foreign correspondent, and it's a great pleasure to welcome her to The Book Show.
It's a great pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
Give us a sense of how you came to this subject, how you came to Wallis Simpson and wanting to delve in to what became a complicated life.
Absolutely. Well, I've always been fascinated by her. I studied history at university, specialized in the 1930s. I've just always known there must be a different version of events. You know, no one woman could be all the things she was painted, Nazi, whore, prostitute, spy, maybe one of them, but not all of them. And then after the Queen Mother's death, that's Queen Elizabeth, the Queen Mother, who you'll have seen in the King's speech, in 2002, there was a slight relaxation in attitudes because those two women had really hated each other. And after her death, there were new papers slowly being released. And then I had written a book about Jenny Churchill, Winston's American mother, and I'd seen how she'd been hated by the establishment, called a mongrel, amongst other things, because she was American. So I figured that, you know, here was an American woman who really the establishment hadn't understood, and that this was the time to look at it.
Give us a sense of her trajectory that eventually landed her in this position. A Baltimore native, born into what type of family?
Oh, a good family. You know, Baltimore's elite. Her father was a Warfield, her mother a Montague. They were both good families. So not, as the Queen Mother later called her, the lowest of the low. You know, all part of what I call the misinformation campaign. But the problem was her father died, T. Wallis Warfield. He was a consumptive. He died when she was just a few months old. So her mother was always an outsider to the Warfield family. They depended on an Uncle Sol Warfield, who was a bachelor, to feed and clothe and educate them and pay an allowance. But he was cruelly controlling. He paid money sometimes into her account and sometimes not a lot or nothing at all. So I think Wallis grew up with this idea that was really seared into her psyche that, you know, you have to depend on a man. On the other hand, you just can't depend on a man. Uncle Sol did pay for her education to Oldfield School. She moved in the right circles, the DuPonts and the Dow families. You know, these were good families. She knew she had to make a good match. But actually, when he refused to pay for a coming-out ball for her, she married a pioneer naval aviator, Win Spencer, who came from Chicago, and he came from an okay family, Chicago stockbroking, but not really rich enough. And the marriage was a disaster. She wanted a divorce. Uncle Sol refused to pay for a divorce. So she sort of wandered the world. And that's when she wandered around in China. He'd been posted to the Far East. And that year in China came to haunt her because subsequently the royal family was said to have documented something called a China dossier with accounts of all her sexual tricks. I'm afraid I don't think the China dossier actually exists, but that was what the Queen Mother and all the British establishment said was obviously her hold on Edward, that she knew how to do things no nicely brought up English girl could possibly know.
I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I just want to address the issue of the Queen Mother and her statements. You can obviously understand her anger, right?
Yes. Yes, no, I can. You know, it's very clear that she never wanted to be queen. She had these two little daughters. She wanted to live a private, quiet life. And again, as you'll have seen in the king's speech, her husband stammered and stuttered, and he was never brought up to be king and to be thrust into the limelight. No, she did not want that life for her family, and she believed that by foisting or forcing her into this role of queen and her husband, who became George VI, and at a terribly stressful time during the war, she believed it actually had shortened her husband's life. In fact, he died of lung cancer, but who knows what the stresses were that added to that. No, you can absolutely understand why somebody like Queen Elizabeth, the former Duchess of York, Elizabeth Bowes-Lyon, would have hated Wallis. She represented everything brash and gold-digging, and she was married twice after Winspencer had failed. She married Ernest Simpson, and here she was carrying on an affair with the heir to the throne, the Prince of Wales, subsequently Edward VIII, with two living husbands. I mean, at a time when divorce was almost illegal in Britain, there was only one ground for getting a divorce in 1936 Britain. You had to prove your husband's adultery. And if it was shown that you also were committing adultery, the wife, then the divorce could not go through. Now, clearly, Wallis got a divorce eventually, but only because the king, Edward VIII, was actively subverting the law of which he was meant to be the supreme upholder. Yes, of course, I can understand why women like the Queen Mother, as she became, or Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, would have hated everything Wallis stood for. And she wasn't alone. You know, many of the English aristocracy really thought Wallis was a no-good gold digger, that the marriage would not last long, and then she'd start blackmailing the king, or the ex-king, the Duke of Windsor, as he became. And what a ghastly scenario that would be.
As you write in the book, neither beautiful nor brilliant, but she was incredibly charming.
Yes, it's terribly hard to explain charisma, because I think that's what it is. I think, you know, there's something about the old-fashioned courtesan, southern, if you like, as several people have said to me this week while I've been touring America. They all say, it's the sort of Scarlett O'Hara southern charm. And certainly it's charisma. It's establishing eye contact. It's the sort of woman, you know, we all know women like this who come into a room, they immediately make an entrance, they captivate the room. And that's something Wallis really worked at from childhood onwards. I learned that when I went to visit her old school. They knew she was somebody who, as soon as she came into a room, captivated it, and all the men fell at her feet. So she had something, and it wasn't brains, it wasn't beauty. She was quick-witted. She was certainly a smart cookie, and in another world where she had to work, had to get a job, I have no doubt she could have had a job. She just decided very early on that a career and a job was not for her. Life was much easier living vicariously through a man. But unquestionably, yes, she had charm. And she played on it.
And not demure. And what do you think it was about her that clicked with Edward VIII?
Well, that's where these extraordinary new letters that you referred to in my introduction come in. Because everyone's always looked at her, as we've just been doing, to say, what was it about her? But actually, if you turn the story on its head and look at him and see what a really needy adolescent he was, and of course he was nearly 40 by the time he met Wallace, so no longer an adolescent. But she still referred to him disparagingly in these letters I've found as Peter Pan, the man who wouldn't grow up, or the boy who wouldn't grow up. So Wallace and Ernest, between them, had this secret code, this insulting way of referring to the man who was giving up everything for her, because they saw that he was flawed, damaged, if you like, deeply needy, and I think unable to face up to his duty. I think very early on, because I've looked at letters to a previous lover as well, where he expresses suicidal wishes. And when he was sent to the front, or begged to be sent to the front in World War I, he also said he didn't mind if he died. After all, he had three other brothers. I think the evidence was there for those who cared to look, and I actually think the royal family probably knew and were very worried about how this man would face up to his responsibilities as king. And I think at some deep level, he knew it as well. He knew he could never be like his father, George V. He just wasn't that sort of macho man. And, you know, if you think of the film Brief Encounter, it was okay to have an affair in this era. What was not okay was to give in to the affair. What was not okay was to give in to a desire for individual fulfillment, personal happiness. That's a terribly modern notion. And the reason Queen Mary, his mother, so hated him and blamed Wallace for encouraging him was that he gave up on his duty. You know, duty and responsibility, they're really the key words of this era. And I think once you understand that actually he wanted to give up on his duty, then you understand why Wallace coming along provided the means for him to get out. She was not the one doing the chasing. It was him. And that's why the story is turned on its head. You see in these letters, she did not want to be queen. She really thought that would never happen, but she couldn't get out of the situation. She was trapped.
Anne Seba is our guest. The name of the book is That Woman, the Wife of Wallace Simpson, Duchess of Windsor. As you make the point, and you write beautifully in the book, that he had such love and adoration for her. And at what point do you believe that she ever reciprocated that, truly?
Oh, that's a terrible question. I hate to be so cynical. You know, this has always been called the greatest love story of the 20th century. And I feel, you know, I'm sort of raining on your parade by saying, hold on, no, it isn't. I think...
Rain away.
I think she loved him in a very superficial way. What she loved was what he offered, and I'm afraid that's material goods. He offered security, jewelry, the fashionable crowd. He made her feel wonderful and terrific, and he admired her. But actually, that sort of slavish devotion bored her after a while, and I think I've spoken to so many people who saw them in their later married life who said she really behaved very badly to him. And he almost seemed to lap that up. He was punishing himself, I think, for giving up on his duty. I mean, it's a very complex psychological problem, but I do think that he recognized he had given up on his duty and craved, first of all, Wallace's punishment of him, and then, of course, the moment of forgiveness was sublime. But love, deep love, no, I don't think so. I think Wallace had passionate love early on for an Argentinian diplomat, Felipe Espil, and he rejected her. And after that, I don't think she ever felt the sort of passionate love of youth. I think what she felt for Ernest, and recognized it too late, you know, more fool her, but what she recognized she had with him was this sort of deep, comfortable love, the sort of love you have perhaps for a father, and what the king or the duke, as he became, had for Wallace was the deep love for a mother. He was looking for a maternal love. So what he loved was the way Wallace controlled him, the way Wallace dominated him.
When you look at Edward and what you said earlier, and this comes through, it was one of the big questions for me in the book, which is that of a self-fulfilling prophecy, where Edward says, I don't feel that I'm fit for this role. I don't want to be king, so I go this route to avoid it. Could there be any truth to that?
Yes, I do think so. I think if you follow the trajectory, I suspect, and this has to be conjecture, but I suspect he was sterile. There is no question he had many other affairs with women during his gilded youth, but there's no evidence of producing a child ever. And so I think that's the ultimate for a monarch, the ultimate failure, not to be able to produce an heir. And I think knowing that was one thing. He didn't have the intellectual acumen, and yet he was a sort of petulant schoolboy. So whether he really deeply understood quite what a failure he would be, I don't know. He didn't have that insight into his personality that actually Wallis did have. She was quite insightful in these letters and often refers to her dual nature, the need to grasp the ambitious side of her nature and, on the other hand, the sort of brittle fragility. But him, I think he really never wanted to be king. As I say, that was clear when he begged to be sent to the trenches and didn't mind if he died there. And also these suicidal wishes to his first lover, Frieda Dudley Ward, and then again to Wallis when she threatens to call it off. She writes this letter when she sees how demonized she is in the rest of the world. She says, you and I will only create disaster together. Let's call it off. And he says, if you leave me, I'll slit my throat. And according to Helen Harding, one of the courtiers, he slept with a loaded gun under his pillow. So I do think that he really, really did not want to be king. And the irony is, the tragedy, if you like, he thought he would come back, live in Fort Belvedere with Wallis, Duke and Duchess of Windsor, having a happy life in the fort with no responsibility, no work, and just all the pleasures. And you're absolutely right when you said at the outset, well, you can understand the Queen Mother, you can understand Queen Elizabeth and King George. They were not having any of that. Why should they be rewarded for this act of dereliction of duty, betrayal, if you like?
As far as what you mentioned early on as some of the criticisms that came her way of being accused of fascist sympathies and having Nazi lovers, do you find truth in any of this? Did you find truth?
That's a really important question. I'm so pleased you've asked, because I wish a lot of people would like me to say, oh yes, they were Nazis. I can't honestly say there is evidence. But what there is this deeply damning photograph of her shaking Hitler's hand and smiling. I mean, how foolish is that? They went to meet Hitler as part of their honeymoon in 1937, and they went for a number of reasons. Now, Edward was certainly pro-German. He believed that a war could be avoided. Well, a lot of people felt that who'd lived through the First World War. There were many appeasers in England who weren't necessarily pro-Nazi. They wanted to avoid a war. But let's look at Edward. He spoke German fluently. He studied German at university. He believed the royal family, quite rightly, was German. They'd been Saxe-Coburg a generation ago. So when Wallis was denied royal initials at a wedding, she was not given the HRH, which meant nobody would curtsy to her. What an insult that was. So where can I take her, Edward thought, that'll make her feel like she's on a state visit and where she'd be treated as queen? I know, let's go and visit Nazi Germany and meet Hitler. Well, I mean, it's hard to imagine anything more foolish. 2 years after the Nuremberg race laws had been passed. So anyone who studied the newspapers, who read, would know that it's not a sensible thing to go to Germany. But You see, they weren't clever and they didn't have advisors. The British establishment had removed from them all sources of good advice, so they relied on whoever they had, and the man at the time was Charles Bedeau, who was doing business with Nazi Germany, who had lent them their chateau for the wedding, Chateau de Condé, and that's how that trip arose. I don't think it necessarily proves that they were pro-Nazi. And to back up that, Baldwin, the prime minister, did not think they were pro-Nazi either. And I think he was in a position to know more than anybody else. Now, the real question arises, I don't think she had Nazi lovers. Ribbentrop, of course, paid visits to her, paid court to her, sent her flowers, because that was his job. His job was to find out people who, if Hitler won, would be friendly towards Germany. So, of course, if Hitler had won and Edward had been king, Wallace would have been in a key position. Again, it doesn't prove she had an affair with him. I think the real issue is the what-if issue. What if Hitler had won and had turned to Edward and Wallace as a puppet king and queen? Would Edward, in his bitterness that was corrosive against the royal family for the way they had treated him, would he have said yes? And my own view is, I think he probably would not have been able to resist. I mean, he was a weak character, and compounded with that was his bitterness. I think it would have been hard for him to say no.
We're just about out of time, but there's one anecdote that you tell in the book, which is just unbelievable. But after Edward died, and they're at the lunch following the funeral, she's seated, and Prince Philip is on one side, and Lord Mountbatten is on the other side, and very quickly they say, what do you intend to do with the Duke's possessions and papers? And she looks at them and says, don't worry, I shan't be coming back here. That is about as sharp as it gets.
Yes, and Mountbatten kept visiting her in Paris, and she loathed his visits and him, because he kept trying to say, oh, this belongs in Windsor, this should go back to Windsor. And as long as she had strength in her body, she resisted him, because she did not think any of it should go back to England. So you do begin to get an idea of the intense bitterness. And of course, ultimately, her jewelry was all sold. Some of it was given away. Some was sold in her lifetime to pay for her nursing care, because she had these dreadful last 6 years in a sort of vegetative, semi-comatose state, cruelly kept alive with a nasal feeding tube, completely out of it. And ultimately, what was left was sold, with most of the proceeds going to the Pasteur Institute. So her possessions have all been sold and dispersed at various times, and perhaps that's a bit of a shame. It would have been quite nice to have a Wallace Windsor collection of jewelry, or perhaps you might say it's quite nice that individuals can buy it and some of it's been bought back by Cartier for the Cartier archive. But, oh, the bitterness certainly got worse, as you rightly say.
The name of the book is That Woman, The Life of Wallis Simpson, Duchess of Windsor. And Seba, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much, and a delight to speak with you.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's lovely for me.
And Seba's new book is That Woman, The Life of Wallis Simpson, Duchess of Windsor. It is published by St. Martin's Press. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows by going to www.wamc.org. Katie Britton produced our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.
Setting fire to our insides for fun, collecting names of the lovers that went wrong, the lovers that went wrong. Chasing visions of our lucky ones, 'cause most of our feelings, they are dead and they are gone. We're setting fire.